You're listening to a Hebrew in Israel podcast with Yoel Halevi, exploring the language, culture, and history of the Bible. For more information, visit us at HebrewInIsrael.net.
Shalom everyone, welcome back to another program, Tzohar LaMikra with Yoel Halevi from Hebrew in Israel. Hope people are enjoying the previous recordings that I put up. This week we are in Parashat Be'alotcha, Be'alotcha. And again, I want us to point out certain things in the parasha, not going over the entire thing. And first of all, a very interesting phenomenon that we have in this week's reading happens to be at the last two verses of chapter 10, which is a segment used in Jewish liturgy, which is verses 35 and 36. It says, Vayhi bin Sa'a Ha'aron Vayomer Moshe, Kuma Adonai Ve'afutzo Evecha Ve'anusu Mesan Echa Mipanecha. And then it says in verse 36, Uvenucho Yomar Shuva Adonai Revot Alfei Israel. Now, the context of this verse is when the ark travels, it says, and when the ark traveled, Moses would say, Arise, Lord, and your enemies will disperse and will flee before you. And all your enemies will flee before you. And it uses the word oivecha and mesanecha, which are synonymous parallels for the concept of enemies and people who hate you, which is usually considered to be an enemy. So a sone is not just someone who hates, it's usually translated as someone who is an enemy. But besides that, we have a piece of liturgy here, which is also used when a Torah scroll was taken out from the ark in the synagogue. And historically speaking, it used to be that the Torah scroll had to travel a distance. Today, most Torah scrolls sit inside a closet or an ark, as some will call it, inside the synagogue itself. But for example, in the Second Temple period, and really mostly in the post Temple period, in the Mishnaic period, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th centuries, especially in the land of Israel, the scrolls were not kept inside the synagogue itself. The scrolls were kept in an extra room on the side where someone could just go in and pick up a scroll and read it to themselves. And synagogues were really mostly study halls. The idea of prayer in a synagogue is I can't say it's a late development, but it's not the original function. Especially, for example, there was an inscription discovered in Jerusalem as the inscription of Todos, which seems to be some kind of an abbreviation of Theodosius. And Todos was a man who donated money to a synagogue. And what he did there is he wrote what the synagogue was for. And it's very clear that it's there for studying and congregation and meeting. And he doesn't mention anything about prayer. But in any case, you have to go to a separate room. Today, the Torah is in the same room to begin with. So the last verse, verse 36, is not really used in Jewish liturgy, but it really says, and when it rested, Benuho, referring to the ark, he would say, Shuva Adonai, return the Lord, or bring back Lord, the tens of thousands and the thousands of Israel. Now this also has a military idea behind it. There's a military concept here that when the Israelites used to go out to war, they would also take the ark. So the ark, when they would go out to war, they would carry the ark on their shoulders. The priests would carry the ark on the shoulders. And because that's really what we see when they enter the land. When they're in the desert, it's very clear the Levites are involved in carrying the vestments of the temple. But the ark, it seems to be, was something the priests would do, especially the moment they cross the Jordan River in times of Joshua. But what we also find here is that this might have been like a battle cry that they would yell out when they would go out to war, and when they returned they would say that God has blessed them, that no one perished in the war. So it raises the question, did they always say this when the ark returned, or did they say this only when they knew no one died, when it was a flawless victory? The other thing about this verse is that it has what's called the reverse nuns. If you actually pick up a Hebrew Bible or look into a Torah scroll, you would see something which looks like a nun or an actual nun, but they're called reverse nuns. You know, usually a nun is written where the opening is to the left. Here they're written when the opening is to the right. So this is why they're called reverse nuns. But when you go further back in manuscripts, those nuns start taking other shapes where the top side at one point, instead of both top and bottom turning to the left, suddenly the bottom part turns to the right, and the top part turns to the left. And it doesn't really look like a nun; it starts looking like something else. And when you really go back to even pre-Masoretic texts, you find not in the texts themselves, but you find a lot of places where there's a reference to this practice. And actually, it says in the Sifri, which is an oral Torah commentary on the biblical text. It's actually one of the earlier stages, and it's before the discussions over what rabbis said. It's really rabbis' discussions over what the Torah is actually saying. So there's the Michilta, which is on the Book of Exodus, the Sifra, which is on the Book of Leviticus, and then you have the Sifri, which is on Numbers and Deuteronomy. And there's been scientific publications of these books and so on, and some of them I think have actually been translated. There are two versions of the Michilta as well. There's the Rabbi Ishmael and Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, each one of them from different discussions. And really, originally in oral law, they would have direct discussions on the verses themselves. The Talmud is really a much later development where they had started having discussions over the discussions of the discussions. But in any case, it says here that Vahi bin Soaron, at the beginning of this of verse 35, Nakud alav milemala umilemata. It's dotted, and when they say Nakud, it comes from the word Nekuda, which means to dot, but really what it means is marked. It is marked above and below, basically in the beginning and the end. So they don't really use the term Nun, they just say marked. Now, I'm actually looking at a book written by a man called Saul Lieberman. And Saul Lieberman was he dealt with Judaics. And he wrote a book called Greek and Hellenism in Jewish Palestine. Because he's really referring to the point where the land of Israel, by the year 135 to the Common Era, was changed into Palestina. Palestine is an incorrect term. It was called Palestina, and it was actually a name given deliberately to scorn Jews because of the idea that the Philistines, and the Philistines were the sea people, and the sea people, some of them at least, came from the Durian culture, which is pre-Greek, pre-Ionian, and they... what it seems to be is that these groups were seen by the Romans as the arch enemies of Israel in the Davidic times, and this is why they chose this name. But in any case, what he actually comes up with is that he researched a lot of influences of the culture of the time, and everyone lives in their culture. I mean, there's nothing you can do about it. Everyone lives in a culture. You take the Bible, and you can also see how it's set in the ancient Near East. And you take Jewish culture, and you also see how it's influenced by the different cultures of the time. If it is Greek or Hellenism, how it influenced the way people did things. If you take, for example, Judaism today, how it's modernized into some liberal thinking and so on. And even people, for example, who are pure Bible followers, people who will not follow anything besides what the Bible says, still come with their baggage of the culture they come from, whatever they may be, from Europe, Africa, Asia, Australia, United States, South America, and so on. Everyone comes with their own baggage, and that baggage that they have, which is their cultural baggage, not baggage in a negative sense, but what they come with, their cultural baggage, does affect the way they understand something. So it's very clear that we can never detach completely from the environment we live in, even if we try to isolate ourselves. Like, for example, what certain groups do, you still are very well aware of what's going on around you. So it's very difficult to avoid any of it. But in any case, what he came up with and what he discovered is that some of the practices of marking a text, if it's dots above a text, like for example in Deuteronomy, I think it's Deuteronomy 29 verse 28, if I remember correctly. And it might be 28 and verse 29. I can't remember exactly which one it is. Actually, if you're already on the topic, I'll just check it very, very quickly. So if you go to Deuteronomy, I think it should be, it should be 29 verse 28. You will see that the words lanu vanenu, and then the ayin, basically the middle of verse 28, there's dots on top. So these dots actually, I personally found these dots in First Temple period marking of text, which is a way of marking this is not supposed to be in the text. And there's actually I think there's a Mishnah or maybe a Breita, which is an external from the word Bar, which is external, Breita, which is an external Mishnah, that states that Ezra the scribe, there are some places he put dots because he wasn't too sure if it's supposed to be there or not. So they were already by that time, they already had some questions about the Torah text. But what we do find is that, for example, in the Mishas Stela, you'll see dots like that as well. It's basically a way of marking a text saying, oh, this is not supposed to be read. So we have that already in a much earlier stage. But then the reverse nuns, according to what Dr. Lieberman came up with, is actually a Hellenistic practice that when you have a text, maybe a song or a story or something, and there's by mistake there's a mixture of clauses where clause is misplaced, it's not in its right place, then what they would do is put a marking that almost looks like an eye. It was really, this is why the text says dotted as well, because it really was a marking almost like an eye. You do a line with a dot on top. And really when they said nakud, they did refer to the dot on top, but they meant the whole thing. This is why I said marking and not dotting, because dotting is something completely different, which is what I mentioned earlier. And they would put that in so the person knows, oh, this is out of its place. Now, was this the same way they treated it in the Torah text as we have it in Numbers 10? I don't think so, because it really is in place, because we're talking about the tribes getting up and traveling, and it is talking about the ark and so on. So the question is, why did very early scribes, you know, second century, maybe even the Dead Sea Scrolls, I mean, I haven't really looked at all the Dead Sea Scrolls, but we might find these markings as well. Is it possible that what they intended was that really these verses are supposed to go somewhere, and we're not 100% sure if this is their place, and then they decide to put it there because it's in context, it does relate to the whole thing, but it's not clear if that's really the place. And it seems to be that some even treated this section as if it's a separate book. If I'm not mistaken, there's a statement by Rebbe, I think. Rebbe, who is, it should be in the same place in the Sifre, that Rebbe said that this is actually a separate book, that this is like a separate section by itself, and this is why it has to be marked as out of place. It's not really out of place, it's not really part of the Book of Numbers. It's some extra part in the Torah that really stands by itself. So this is a very, very intriguing thing. It is not very common to find reverse nuns, as they're called. The only other time it happens, if I remember correctly, is in the Book of Samuel, I think. And that's the only other place, as far as I remember. Happens in the Book of Samuel, and I think it happens at least one more, happens a few more times in the Book of Psalms. There's a very, very long psalm that has a whole bunch of reverse nuns there, which is also, I think there it's the most peculiar case, because it really, the verses flow with one another, and for some reason it's there. But in any case, that's about the reverse nunim that sometimes people ask about. The last thing I want to talk about here is the 70 elders, 72 elders, and then two of them were removed. And it actually states here a little bit about how they did things. For example, it mentions that the Eldad and Medad had the Spirit come upon them. And there's a whole thing about, really, it's really the spirit of prophecy of Moses, and all the prophets after Moses really are a continuation of Moses. The same way, for example, Elisha was a continuation of Elijah, and or Elisha and Eliyahu, and Elisha became a prophet through the spirit of the spirit that came upon Eliyahu. And some people, some better just mentioning this, there's a question of how much of the spirit did Elisha actually get, and he used the word kiflaim. And some translations say that it's half, like folding something in half, so he only received half of the power of Eliyahu, but kiflaim can also be seen as the word kefil, which means twice. So I've actually heard from different people that I know that there are different versions of translation of what that verse in the book of Kings actually says. But regarding the 70 elders, we actually, first of all, there are two versions of how these 70 elders came to be, because there's the version in Exodus that says that Jethro recommended taking members from each tribe, representatives from each tribe, to help Moses. And then we have another version here that says, oh, God told him to take 70 elders. And then we have in Deuteronomy, and if I remember correctly, is another version that says that the people suggested or something, that they will have people leading them. And really, it raises a question of, you know, how can it be that we have these different versions? And the answer is very, very simple. We need to understand that this section, these sections of the Torah, we call the historical memory. There's the Torah as the laws, and then there's the historical memory that's passed down in the books. And, you know, there's the known debate about what exactly is the Torah that Moses received from God, and is it exactly the same text that we have today, and is every single letter that we have in our hands exactly as Moses ascribed it, and so on. But when you come to places like this, it really raises a question, and it's a well-known debate in the academic world. But I think the answer is very, very simple, that notice that each one of them describes really a different situation, and that it could be that they elected 70 elders during the times of Jethro. But again, we need to understand that the story of Jethro is not necessarily in the place it should be. I've mentioned this in the past in other places, that it could be that what we're actually looking at is a separation of the same story into three different places from three different perspectives. That Moses was giving judgment to the people, Jethro saw this, and it doesn't state in the verses there when Jethro actually met Moses. Was it before Mount Sinai, after Mount Sinai, way after Mount Sinai? It's not very clear. It seems to be that chapter 19 in Exodus is kind of also, again, out, like the verses here in Numbers 10, they're kind of out of place. That it's, we're throwing in a piece of information here, but this is not necessarily in its rightful place. And therefore, if I take that story from Exodus, and I take the story we have here in Numbers, and I then look what happened in Deuteronomy, we're probably looking at the same story from different perspectives. Jethro saw the difficulty that Moses had with the people, having to rule them and give judgment over different situations. Then Moses received permission from God, as Jethro suggested, that if God sanctions it, then we can consider this choosing of these men as legitimate. But we're now seeing it from the perspective of probably what really triggered the will of God to allowing people to help Moses inside the story. And then from the what we have in Deuteronomy is already a discussion there from another perspective, where the people realize they need a few more leaders. So I think we're really looking at the story from just three different perspectives, and not necessarily looking at three separate stories. Again, it's a rationalization that I'm doing. Some people might find weaknesses in it, and I will understand that. Really, this specific parasha of Be'alotcha is a collection, or the beginning of the collection, of all the difficulties that happened in the desert, and all the arguments and so on. And we need to understand, if you look close to all these arguments, most of these arguments are arguments of leadership, of control, of who's in power, who's leading whom and so on, which is something that I think this is an argument that exists to this very day. Everyone's arguing who has the power to lead, who has the authority to lead, and so on. And really, at the end of the day, what we're left with is that there are no actual people who can prove that they're actual prophets. People who might have visions or whatever it might be, or dreams, can argue that they're prophets. But again, are they really prophets? Is there really a way of proving it? But still, what we do find, and this is, I think, one of the reasons why it's positioned here as well, is we talk about a lot about the Levites and the priests in the previous book, and also in the beginning of this parasha. And I think that one of the things that still stands is the fact that the Torah gives authority to Levites and priests and elected people who can be seen as judges. So going into the argument of who has the right to lead, I think that the one thing we can know for sure is that the Torah says that Kohanim, Leviim, and Shofet Asher Bayamim Ahem, the judge or the ruler which is in those days. So today, I think that though people think that, you know, because they can read the Torah and so on, they have the authority, I think that people like that should realize that that they can have authority if they're accepted by the community. You can't just march and say, I know the truth and therefore I am going to tell everyone what they can do. I think that's a very, very unhealthy approach, and I think that that kind of approach is some of the damage that we see here in the Book of Numbers. So I think the Book of Numbers is also a book that teaches us a moral point here, is that it's important to remember that if you're going to be a leader, you have to be a leader that's accepted by society and not just a leader to yourself and wanting to say that you govern everyone that surrounds you. In any case, very, very difficult topic. I understand that this might make some people cringe. I've unfortunately had my share of debates with people about what is leadership and so on. And this is a well-known, documented fight that we find also from the Hasmonean period. What happened with the Kohen Tzedek, who seems to be the man who established the Essene movement, who has power, who has control. And, you know, it's a very, very sad and difficult thing to speak about, but it's just the reality that we live in. So, you know, ending this recording with a prayer that may we see priests back, Kohanim back at their place, at their work, and Levim back at their positions, and judges in their rightful places, with prophets leading the people with the will of God.